So last week, we looked at chapter 22, and mostly that was laws about property. Some of the examples included what God established for restitution for thievery. If you were stealing an animal, often that was 2-to-1. We looked at God gave the acceptability to defend your own personal property and personal property ownership, and how you could use deadly force to protect your property, but if it was in the daytime, deadly force was not condoned. You ought to be able to handle it without that. The thief that is destitute can be sold into slavery to repay the debt for his thievery. Thievery by grazing, stealing somebody else's produce of their ground to take care of their own animals, would be repaid by you providing of your very best to make up for that. Talked about negligence, that if you started a fire and it got away and it burned grain and so on in fields, you were going to have to make restitution. Talked about how you were to care for animals that you might borrow and your responsibilities if they were harmed. Also spent some time talking about the seduction of the unmarried women. There was a bride price, and if the father wouldn't allow a marriage to come out of that, then there was still the price paid, but it was more as restitution rather than as a dowry. God put some strong words that we saw about care not to oppress orphans or widows, and how he would take up their cause if you did. God said, don't curse God, which makes sense, or the rulers. And don't delay bringing in your offerings, including the firstborn of the animals. God had claimed the firstborn after the Passover time as they were leaving Egypt. He said, set aside the firstborn males from both animals and from mankind, that they would be his. And he talked back in at that time about how to redeem some of those animals and mankind. Now today, we're moving forward, and we're going to be talking about justice, a popular topic in today's world, isn't it? With all kinds of definitions in today's world, but I think from what we'll see today, God's definition and expectations regarding justice are pretty straightforward and make good sense to people that aren't perverted in their thinking, is how I would say it. So today we're going to be looking at chapter 23, and so we'll see about some of those, about God's justice, as well as, I don't know that we will get to his role in the, I don't expect to get to his role in the conquest of Canaan, how what he's going to do, but that's also in chapter 23. So let's start out. I want to read verses 1 through 8, and we'll talk about those. You shall not bear a false report. Do not join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not follow the masses in doing evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after a multitude in order to pervert justice. Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his dispute. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, you shall surely return it to him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying helpless under its load, you shall refrain from leaving it to him. You shall surely release it with him. You shall not pervert the justice due to your needy brother in his dispute. Keep from a false charge and do not kill the innocent or the righteous, for I will not acquit the guilty. You shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of the just. I'm going to read one more. You shall not oppress a stranger, since you yourselves know the feelings of a stranger, for you also were strangers in the land of Egypt. I meant through verse 9, I just wrote it down wrong. So God starts out in his laws. We're talking now about interactions that would be maybe in the public arena, as far as just, I'm going to use the word, the gossipy kind of stuff, but, you know, talking about people. But it also could be in the very legal court arena where you're providing testimony in a case before a judge. where they're trying to determine what's right and wrong and what to do and who's to be held accountable and whether something really happened here that needed to be put under judgment. And he starts out with, do not give out false testimony. Don't say things that aren't true. But instead, be truthful. Don't join with the wicked to support malicious lies. Why would you be inclined to join with the wicked to support malicious lies? What would be a motivation to do that?
If it's socially expedient.
Yeah. It's a lot easier to go with the crowd than to oppose the crowd, even when you know the crowd is wrong, right? I heard some speculation from a news source the other day about some, there was a group of people, they said, well, some in there are not telling how they're going to vote, which, why are you asking them how they're going to vote anyway? That's kind of supposed to be your own business, but anyway. Certain people reach a certain prominence where they want to know, well, what are you going to do? What are you going to vote for? What do you support? And they said, well, there's a group of them that just aren't saying, probably because they're going to support a particular candidate's name starts with a T, you know how that all goes. They're probably supporting Trump, but they don't want to say so because of the unpopularity they perceive would be in their work group. And some are even saying they're voting for the Democratic candidate, but they probably really aren't. Just the pressures to go along. Well, they're not necessarily, they might be telling falsehoods if I'm going to vote for one, but I say I'm going to vote for another. I would just say that's none of your business if I didn't want to talk about it. Why can't you say that these days? But anyway, maybe you can't afford to have them assume anything about you. I don't know. But there's so much social pressure these days. What do they call it? Virtue signaling? I got to sound like I'm on their team or they're going to say I'm a bigot or I'm hateful or whatever. I don't know how we got to a definition of hate that what it means is I don't choose to openly, publicly agree with what you just said. If I don't do that, I hate you. That's where we're at with what they say is hate speech. And that's just crazy. I mean, you talk about, it was interesting when I was a kid to hear the story of the emperor who had the fancy clothes that the magicians made that you could only see if you were a just person or something. I don't remember what the ones that were supposed to be able to see it, but he really was naked. You know? These magicians were telling everybody how wonderful the clothes were, and the king that they were putting them on, he wouldn't say anything because he, you know, if you didn't agree with these magicians who were making them clothes, then you were flawed. So everybody agreed till this little kid saw the parade with the emperor going around naked. And he says he has no clothes on. You all have heard the story, I'm sure. Well, you talk about a setting where that could really happen. I mean, we're closer to that today than we've been in lots of times in our own experiences. Well, God here says, tell the truth. Does that mean you always have to tell everything you know? I suppose that there are times it's just better to remain silent. But nonetheless, if you speak, the only thing that should come out of you is truthfulness according to God's own direction as he's establishing this country, this nation, Israel. You know, I talked about why would you go along with the crowd? In verse 1 there, he also says, not join hand with the wicked man to be a malicious witness. Why would the wicked man want a malicious witness? This isn't a hard question. This is pretty easy. Why would the wicked be trying to entice people to support them by saying things that weren't true? Well, they're wicked.
To get their way.
What's that?
To get their way.
Get their way.
Personal gain.
They're either seeking money or power or maybe even revenge. So they're trying to accomplish something. They're trying to do something that is evil and wrong. And so you wouldn't want to be joined with them anyway. So they wicked might be involved with those kinds of things, maybe impression. What kind of settings would you be in? The wicked might be asking you to take part in lawsuits or similar. In today's world, the wicked want us to agree with them just so they can have their place and let their views be considered right, when indeed they might very well be wrong. Questions, comments on verse 1? Yes, sir.
Rick, I was thinking about this. So in this culture, obviously the amount of technological oversight that they have
yeah.
is a lot different than what we have today. If you get something stolen from you at Walmart, there's security footage. There's like things that we can point to say, hey, this is evidence in this particular case. In this culture, all the evidence that they had for all of these heinous crimes that existed were the evidence of two or three witnesses. And mm-hmm. So we're talking about crimes that would... Basically, if you worked with someone who is malicious and accused someone of something with two or three witnesses, the punishment was death, right, in a lot of these instances. And so it can get pretty hairy in this culture if you have someone who is malicious, who wants to own his neighbor's property, who accuses his neighbor of something, and then gets his friend to come in with him on an accusation mm-hmm. to say that this X, Y, or Z happened, then there's no recourse for the person who's accused. In this culture, right? They're going to be put to death because there's evidence of two or three witnesses. And so I think that we see some of these similarities in our culture today. I think if you look back at the justices put in by the Trump administration, like Brett Kavanaugh, for instance, right? We got put through the ringer on these charges that were levied from 25 or 30 years ago, which is why the statute of limitations exists, right? So that justice isn't perverted, so that people's lives aren't ruined by false and ridiculous accusations like that. So just something to think about.
Yeah, and, you make a good point. I hadn't really thought about the fact the consequences were much higher based on testimony in that era. Yes, sir.
It's really nothing new. If we look at Lawrence, 257 people killed, and one of the main things they did was anti-technology. They took both printing presses and threw them in the river because they didn't want the Republicans putting out anti-slave literature.
Well, and yeah, I mean, history is full of people who behave this way, and God was trying to head that off a bit here, at least letting them know when you do that, you're working against me. So, yeah, absolutely. So verse 2, he goes on with don't follow the crowd. Don't follow the masses in doing evil. So now this isn't just what you say. Now we're over into what you do. Is that a problem today? Wow. And an interesting thing is when you look at Romans 1, I've mentioned it several times in class, but that progression that societies go down when they suppress the truth and unrighteousness as they keep going down, at the end point is all this sexual perversion. And that's what we're seeing today. It just looks like our society's gone down that Romans 1 path. And the crowd not only goes along it and does those things, but people are there giving hearty approval to those who do them. And don't we have hearty approval today? So he says, don't get caught up in the crowds and their evil. Don't testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after the multitude in order to pervert justice. We've kind of already talked about that, making your testimony go along with what's going on in the popular side of it. And then verse 3 is really... a watershed verse in many ways. Don't show partiality to a poor man in a dispute. Now, it was interesting. I wanted to make sure I was looking at this right, so I looked up the words that go along with partiality, and it says, don't honor or put give your countenance to. The root word here is a swell up kind of a meaning. Don't swell this guy up. Don't make more of him than he is in this judgment just because he is poor. And I think it's interesting that what God is recognizing here is this tendency out of your compassion for somebody who's living in a tough situation to try to put your thumb on the scales for their benefit. Well, that's a poor guy, and this is going on, and a tendency to take his side because of his poorness, not because of his rightness. And But when you read that in today's world, you might go, was he saying to help him because he's poor or to not help him? You know, the way the English says it, you could maybe talk yourself into both. And I was a little shocked after looking up the words, what they mean. It's very clear that if you've got a poor man in the courts, it doesn't affect what justice looks like. Now, it doesn't say outside of this justice moment, if your heart is turned because of his plight, that you can't go help him. But it just says in this dispute, don't move outside of justice. There are commentators that very much in the minority, but there were a couple that said, no, this means you should show partiality and help him out. You should put your thumb on the scale because he's poor. Have you ever thought about what that does? When we show partiality to somebody because of who they are, what's happened to them in life, what their background is, in a dispute, in a civil lawsuit or something like that, what does that do for people's thoughts about justice? What if you are the one that isn't the poor man but's accused by the poor man unjustly? And they fine for the poor man because he's poor. What's your thoughts about our justice system at that point? Faith begins to erode. And the next time that an issue comes up, they might find in favor of somebody because of their views, not because they're poor. Am I describing anything yet? Can you see this happening in our own, right in front of us? I don't want to get into politics this morning, but there's a whole lot going on where it's at least very, very questionable what these accusations are about, what were they guilty of, what's going on here. And once you lose faith in the justice system, it justifies all kinds of evil actions. It would tend to justify. I don't want to say it makes it okay to do things, to take law into your own hands as a righteous man. I don't think that's approved or acceptable. But it sure makes it tempting, doesn't it? I can't trust the courts anymore. What can I trust? How do I live? How do I move forward? And so then that permeates through a society, and the society's stuck. Until they straighten up the court system, straighten up their justice system, so their justice system is just in all situations as best they can do it continuously. We're stuck. Russell brought up the technological limitations. I won't, but I could tell you a story how the police tried to use one of those technological situations against an innocent person by telling them lies. That was really interesting. But nonetheless, even with our technological systems, it's really difficult sometimes to find out what the truth is. Sat on a jury one time, we got all done, we were uncomfortable as jurors about the decisions we made, but we thought we'd sorted it out to the best of our ability, and we did find some guilt and exonerated the person accused in some other areas. And afterwards, the judge said, you guys want to talk? And they always do that, I think. Every jury I've been on, they've done that. And sure. So he came on back as a man I respect a whole lot. And we just kind of said, this was tough. He said, yeah. He said, this whole case, you knew that everybody that was giving testimony was lying. Every one of them had an issue or a stake in the outcome of this, and you knew every one of them was lying. So somehow you had to take their lies and try to figure out what the truth was, admit in the midst of all their lies. And he said, if this had not been a jury trial, I would have come up with exactly the same findings you did. But what really happened, we'll probably never know. And so anyway, those things are out there. It's always difficult, but the justice system needs to be as upright and straightforward and fair as it can be, regardless of the background of the person in front of the justice system. Does that make sense? I think that's what God's saying here. Don't let this crack start, because it will find all kinds of other things that will come into that fissure and will break apart the justice system. Slippery slope. Decisions must be based on facts, not emotion. Empathy's good, but it can lead to rationalizing away the intended or just results. Speaks very much against unequal law enforcement. So in verse 4, he moves on to dealing with, if you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, what are you going to do? So what are you supposed to do according to God? This is your enemy. This is the guy that's been opposing you, maybe verbally, maybe other ways, whatever. You guys are enemies, and you see his critter out here having jumped the fence, wandering away. What are you supposed to do? The fact your enemies doesn't change who it is. That old saying, finders keepers, doesn't apply in God's kingdom. If you can figure out whose it is, you take it back to them. And verse 5, I think, is equally important. If you see a donkey of someone that hates you, this guy hates you. What's implied with hate? What does Jesus link with hate? Murderous intent. Here's a guy that hates you, and you see him and his donkey, and his donkey has collapsed under the load he's put on the donkey. Be real tempting to say some really snide comments like, "Yeah, you treat your donkey like you treat people. You overloaded him and broke him down." Well, anyway, that isn't what you're supposed to do. What are you supposed to do when you come across this man and his donkey that is in trouble because he's been overburdened?
Redeem it.
Yeah. You help the guy get his donkey unloaded so that his donkey can be saved from this situation. And so what God is setting up is a situation where even your enemies, as you see them, you treat them justly. You help take care of their property, even though they're an enemy. Both in returning it, if you find it out loose, if it's an animal, also in helping save that animal from a problem. He could have used an example. God could have said, if you find his donkey in a ditch, you help him get it out. It would be the same kind of a thought process, and it should be carried over into other situations. Verse 6 is about, you have a needy brother. So someone that's family, that's close to you, in some sense, brother here could mean literal brother, right in your own immediate family, or it could mean a fellow Jew. But you shall not pervert justice to help your needy brother in his dispute. That's pretty broad, isn't it? You know somebody in need, you could aid the justice system in helping him by perverting it so he gets some sort of help, but don't do that. It's very similar to verse 3. What does needy mean? Maybe poor, maybe other things, but regardless of what the need is, you can't become a part of perverting justice to take care of it, to make an outcome that you want. You still got to let justice remain justice and let it prevail. In verse 7, you shall keep far from a false charge. Can you put that in practical terms? What did God just ask them to do? Keep far from a false charge. What would be a false charge? Well, I must have found a hard question in there somewhere.
You stole something from me.
Okay, you stole something from me. If you know that that's a false charge, what's God asking you to do in respect to that charge? What does it mean to keep far from it?
Stay away.
Stay away. Don't get involved in a false charge situation. And if everybody that knew it was false would do that, what would happen to the charge? It would dry up, wouldn't it? Part of getting far from a false charge is, Russell mentioned it earlier, what did it take to say this is a true statement in the court system?
Witnesses.
At least three that would agree. And if you remember Jesus' trials, that was the problem. They had plenty of witnesses accusing Jesus, But what they accused him of didn't sound the same with everybody. They said different things, whatever. They didn't get their stories lined up, so as a result, they couldn't find him guilty. I don't know if you realize that or not, but they couldn't find him guilty in the true trial in front of the high priest. And so, I shouldn't say in front of the high priest. I shouldn't do this because I'm going to get the names all confused. But the man who really held the power, wasn't Caiaphas the high priest? And so the man who really had the power was Caiaphas's father-in-law. And he would get his henchmen put in charge of as being high priest. The Romans worked with the Jews to set the high priest. And they were in front of Ananias. Ananias was his name. And in front of Ananias, they're sitting there trying to figure out what they're going to testify at Jesus, and they can't figure it out. So they just go ahead and send him to Caiaphas. And Caiaphas can't make it work either, but they still take him to Pilate. But anyway, got to have three testimonies. If everybody that knew it was false, that didn't actually know what happened, would stay away, the case would just dry up, wouldn't it? Can't go anywhere. You don't have anybody to take the court with you to back up what you said. So it would just die in the Jewish system. In our time, do we stay away from false claims as a populace? I don't think so. I think people voice their politics and worry about the falseness or the correctness later in many cases. And so there are plenty of false charges that are put out there and live because people support it. Don't just stay away from it and just ignore the few people that want to make those kinds of false charges. Matter of fact, there might be a place you might have to be called to get involved with a false charge. If somebody asked you to testify and you knew that it was false and you had the facts and the data, you should be right there saying so. But if we go on, in verse 7, God says this, and continuing in verse 7, do not kill the innocent or the righteous, for I will not acquit the guilty. You have to look at that verse just a minute to figure out who the guilty is. He says, don't kill the innocent or the righteous. Whether you're in a court situation, you put them to death, or you do it by your own hand, don't do that. Why? I will not acquit the guilty. Who's the guilty? You are. For killing, being a part of, putting to death the innocent or the righteous. Verse 8, you shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause for the just. Well, we can certainly understand the last part very easily. Bribes are given so that people will make decisions that aren't just based on what decisions should be made. Whether you're ignoring wisdom or whether you're ignoring truth, and probably both, the bribe moves things away from the simple do the right thing every time. And so it does subvert the cause of the just. The just person shouldn't need a bribe to be involved to get justice. It ought to work that justice flows down without a bribe. But I like the words here. A bribe blinds the clear-sighted. Can't see the truth after you take the bribe. First of all, you're probably not looking for it. Secondly, you're willingly going to be blind so that you can make the decision you want to. Take a few bribes and you probably lose track of what justice would have looked like anyway, because of the perversions that are adding up. And then verse 9, you shall not oppress a stranger because you know the feelings of a stranger. You were strangers in the land of Egypt. Okay, so in what way were they strangers in Egypt? I'm asking that question so we can get at a good definition of a stranger in this verse. How were they strangers in Egypt?
They were born there. They didn't originate from there.
Well, actually, by the time we get to the time of Moses, do you think there were any there that didn't weren't born there? Probably not very many, maybe some. But in terms of descendants of Jacob, They were all born there, weren't they?
Did they not follow the same customs as the Egyptians?
They did maintain different customs. We know that from the archaeology. The burials, you can tell, for the Semitic people was different than how they did the burials for the Egyptians.
Rick, this is really talking about national identity.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're looking at the word stranger, like the Greek version would be like xenos, like xenophobia, I guess, mm-hmm. is kind of what we're talking about here. But I think it's really clear, like we need to have a very clear definition, like you said. And so what it's talking about is people who were removed from their original homeland and were spending a time for a season in a separate land with the plan to return to their homeland again. And so it's really talking about exiles from a particular place and time.
Yeah, and I think, unfortunately, maybe, because of God's intention is a little different, I think we can even go just a little bit further than that, because they're going to be marching into Canaan, right? And God directed them in most cases. There were some exceptions, and I'm not prepared to just tell you about them right in this second, but there were some very minor exceptions where God appreciated how people had treated Abraham, and he said, or his descendants, and said, leave them alone. But for the most part, it was no survivors, no men, no women, and no children. But there would be some people in that land after they conquered it who were not descendants of Abraham. And I think for this particular verse in this particular setting, I think that's what we're talking about. Don't oppress other people groups, whether they're people that have lived there a long time or not, because you were a people group lived there a long time, and they really weren't planning on going home. God was planning on taking them home, but they knew they were oppressed. They knew they wanted change, but even when Moses was listening to God speak, well, why would they follow me out? It's not that they wanted to go so bad. They were looking for the first guy leaving town they could go with. But at any rate, this is so that if they're not Jews, I'll say it that way, if they're not descendants of Abraham, doesn't mean you should oppress them, and you know what it's like to be oppressed. They lived through it and were dependent upon God in taking care of them to get them out. And so just because they're not like you in whatever way you want to say it doesn't mean that there's somebody that you can treat poorly.
I was just going to say too. I think with the conquest of Canaan, you see examples of aliens who are assimilated to the nation of Israel. Rahab the prostitute would be a prime example of this, right? So like, there are people who are other, who are assimilated into the nation of Israel, and then there's a second category of folks who, after the conquest of mm-hmm. Canaan, after the conquest of Israel and the Promised Land, who are fleeing persecution or whatever, who need a haven of some sort. And I think that's. In my opinion, the people he's talking to here, as he's defining this national constitution for the people of Israel. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, in my mind, there's a distinction between those who are willing to assimilate into the Israeli culture, mm-hmm. who are willing to become a part of that nation and forsake their connections to previous nations, and a different population who, for a time and season, come to the nation of Israel and then are removed back to their original homeland.
Yeah, and I really wouldn't argue with what you said. As a matter of fact, I appreciate very much your example of Rahab the harlot, because she would be one that would fit well to try to figure this out. Of course, the other thing I would say is, when the Israelite clan came to Egypt, they were fit in well. I mean, in one sense. The Egyptian pharaoh treated them as a very good people, a very great people. Now, they did look down on shepherds, and they were shepherds, and they stayed shepherds. But because of Joseph and the early generations, they were definitely assimilated into the culture. Over time, they became afraid of them because it became so large. But I don't think we need to split that hair too far. I generally agree with what you say, Russell. But the bottom line is, don't find an excuse to oppress people just because they're not like you, because you know what that's like. Sir?
Over and over again, they're finding that the Jews made beer, and only the best treated people in Egypt could afford to make beer. So there's much evidence that they weren't necessarily slaves, they were being paid very well.
Well, they were definitely slaves by the time they left.
They
didn't start out slaves, but they were by the time they left. So let's take a look back at verses 1 through 8. And what I want you to realize is that God is providing them with rules to live by for their society for a reason. And it starts out with, don't lie, don't give false testimony, don't help the courts to pervert justice, either for the rich or for the poor. Don't follow the culture into evil. And if you keep going down through this list, would God have provided unnecessary laws? He realized where these people were going to go without his direction. Now, unfortunately, mankind's good at rebelling against God and going those same places anyway, even with the direction. But the kind of directions he's giving them, some of them, I mean, like, take your enemy's animal back. Okay, that's going to set them apart. That might not be as striking in terms of the way the society treats itself. It might be very striking to outsiders. Why would you do that for an enemy? But when we add up these other things, God expected them to need to be told, here are things that are evil and wrong. That starts out at the top with tell the truth, keep your justice system straight, don't follow the crowd that wants to be evil, and so on and so on. Just imagine the kinds of things that God was keeping them away from. Keep your fingers off the scales of justice. Your culture can go down when you let these things get out of hand, and that's what he's trying to keep them from doing. And don't align with the rich, the popular, or the briber when they want to do evil. Deals with hatred between citizens, ignoring the needs of others, bribery. This is a fascinating one for me. Don't kill the innocent or the righteous. That happens more frequently than we might care to know throughout the world. And so God's establishing a culture of truth and justice, along with consideration of others, through these commands. He's establishing his priestly nation with the commands. Questions, comments over those first 9 verses? Okay, well, let's look at verses 10 through 13. And God changes gears here from these laws for their culture to his own implementation of a Sabbath in multiple settings. First of all, you shall sow your land for 6 years and gather its yield. But on the 7th year, you shall let it rest and fallow, so that the needy of your people may eat, and whatever they leave, the beast of the field may eat. You are to do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. 6 days are you to do your work, but on the 7th day, you shall cease from labor, so that your ox and your donkey may rest. And the son of your female slave, as well as your stranger, may refresh themselves. Now concerning everything which I have said to you, be on your guard, and do not mention the name of other gods, nor let them be heard from your mouth. And so God is bringing to them now an expansion from what we've seen in other situations with regard to the concept and the implementation of a Sabbath. So go sow your fields, work them for 6 years, and gather in the crops for those 6 years. But the 7th year, in verse 11, you're not going to sow nor gather. But what is going, God gives us the purpose for that. What's his purpose in saying, leave your field for that 7th year? God says it right there. Why does he say to do that? Well, the ground can rest. The poor and even the animals can eat of its harvest. But you didn't sow, so what are they going to eat?
Volunteer,
yeah. They were not, today's many hybrid seeds won't reproduce if you go out and shell the corn and plant them. At least if they reproduce, it won't be the corn you thought you were going to get. But there are many seeds that have, they call them legacy, I think. I'm not into this very much.
Heirloom,
that's what I'm trying to say. And they will continue to produce. Well, if you look at the rest of the laws God gives here, and we're not going to turn to this one, we will turn to some others. But he says, don't harvest the corners. And, you know, leave some areas that are going to not get harvested. That, too, is for animals and for poor folk. And so there's going to be seed. modern machinery does a pretty good job of harvesting all the seeds out, but there's still quite a bit that gets left even from modern harvesting equipment. And so as they go through the time of gathering in for their harvest, there's going to be seed that's going to grow. And so he says, do that and include your vineyard, which, what do you grow in a vineyard? Grapes, as well as your olive grove. And certainly we know this is good for the land. I mean, it does help it out. But God's stated reason is really for the people. It's also a testimony, if as the people do it, to God about his provision for them. Because we're going to take a year off, we're not going to intentionally grow, and we're not going to harvest. And so the ground is good enough, though, they can survive off of the 6 years, but there's even more to it than that. Go over to Leviticus chapter 25. We'll do this one first. Leviticus chapter 25. This is the parallel account where this is being restated. Later on, as they're making their way toward taking the promised land. And we're going to look at verse 18 through 22. And this is about what they're to do. You shall thus observe my statutes and keep my judgments, so as to carry them out, excuse me, that you may live securely on the land. Then your land will yield its produce so that you can eat your fill and live securely on it. But if you say, what are we going to do, eat on the seventh year? And if we do not sow or gather in our crops, then how will I order my blessing for you in the sixth year? I'm sorry, let me back up and read that correctly. What are we going to eat on the seventh year if we do not sow or gather our crops? Verse 21. Then I will so order my blessing for you in the sixth year, that it will bring forth the crop for 3 years. When you are sowing the eighth year, you can still eat old things from the crop, eating the old until the ninth year when the crop comes in. So God isn't just going to provide enough so that they can survive the seventh year. He's going to provide a 3 times harvest on the sixth year if they follow his directions. And they will have a plenty to carry them through the seventh year and even into the eighth year. Well, why would they need to go into the eighth year? Well, they were also planting crops that they planted in the fall and harvested in the spring. They were also planting crops that they planted in the late, in the early spring and harvested then in the summer or late summer like we do. So they had, it's like us and wheat and us and corn. We plant our wheat in the fall, we harvest it in the spring or near spring, the next year. And so if they didn't plant in the seventh year to get things going, when they get to the first of the next seven or the eighth year, they're planting, but there's nothing to harvest until they're at least halfway through that year. So that's why God is providing so well for them. And I'm sure that God did it. Is there any doubt in your mind that that's exactly what God did? But we do have a little bit of doubt about what they did. Go over to 2 Chronicles 36. 2 Chronicles 36. We're going to look at verses 20 and 21. And where we're reading is 2 Chronicles 36. This is the Judean captivity, and it's information about the length of their captivity and a little bit about why it happened. So if we go down to verse 20, We see the Babylonian captivity mentioned in its beginning. Verse 20. Those who had escaped from the sword, he carried away to Babylon, and they were servants to him and to his sons until the rule of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until all the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days of his desolation, it kept Sabbath until 70 years were complete. What is it talking about there? What does it mean, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths? Well, the Israelites enjoyed planting and gathering crops, tried to do better than they would have done under God's hand, apparently, and they quit observing that seventh year of letting the ground lie fallow and letting the poor and the animals enjoy eating it. And by the way, I was humored when I read this. Also lets your working beasts rest. Your oxen, your donkey can get a year where they don't have to be out working every day. And so here they are. They're just being worldly and trying to get the most off their ground instead of realizing God would bless them even more greatly if they'd done what he said. And apparently for about 490 years, they had neglected the Sabbath for the ground. And so when God took them into captivity, Jeremiah said it was for 70 years, because if you add all up all the weeks for 490 years, all the years that every seventh year would be fallow for 490 years, that's enough years to make 70 years. And so God said, fine. If you won't let the ground go fallow, I'll fallow the ground for you. And he carted him off to Babylon, and the ground then was unused, at least by the Israelites, and by many people. It was not repopulated in much depth for 70 years until Persia comes to power, and then we get the story of Esther, and we get Nehemiah, and all the return to Jerusalem to try to rebuild the nation. So God was not just making suggestions about letting the ground go fallow 1 year out of every seven. And I'm assuming, because of the way he talks about how he's going to take care of them and the way this was to be for the people and so on, that all of the agricultural community farmed the same 6 years and everybody was fallow on the seventh. I think they did this in unison when they did it properly. So God was very serious about that. Let's go back to Exodus again. And let's look at verse 12 in chapter 23. He goes back to the original Sabbath. 6 days you are to do your work, but on the seventh day you shall cease from labor, so that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the son of your female slave as well as your stranger may refresh themselves. So this is where he brings in the animals. So 1 day a week, the seventh day, is a day to rest. And when God originally instituted this, he mentioned it in that. Created the world in 6 days and rested the seventh. So this is God's pattern. He's asking them to follow it. It should remind them of creation, should remind them of God's strength and greatness, and they should be worshiping God by following his command there. And then we get to verse 13, and he says, "Now concerning everything which I have said to you, be on your guard, and do not mention the name of other gods, nor let them be heard from your mouth." God starts out with, "Be on your guard." How would you take that? When God says, "Be on your guard," what is he asking you to do?
Be watchful.
Be watchful.
Disciplined.
Disciplined. This is a time to be very careful, be very diligent. Pay close attention. Understand this. Set your heart to obey it. Don't waver on it. Get it straight. Get it right. And what does he tell them not to do? Don't mention names of other gods, nor let them be heard from your mouth. Why would this be so important? Now, there's some obvious answers to that, and they're good answers, so don't be afraid to say them. But why would it be so important to God that you not speak the names of other gods?
You need to know where your blessings are from.
Yeah, keep track of where your blessings are from. Okay, why else?
He's a jealous God.
He is a jealous God. And he doesn't want to share any of the honor that's due him with anything, any other, I'm going to say the word God. They're not real beings, right? They're false gods. Why else? Yes, sir.
MacArthur says it prohibits interracial marriage.
That's an interesting one, and I had that down to make sure we brought up at some point. Yeah, and do you want to explain why? I can, or you can, doesn't matter.
No, you go ahead.
Well, the marriage ceremonies, when they would intermarry with other, with people who followed these false gods, they're going to mention the name of their God in the marriage ceremony. Not if you're marrying my son or my daughter. No, we're not doing that. And so it really takes away the opportunity for intermarriage to even occur because, I mean, the tension when I was a kid was sometimes a young man who was Protestant would get linked up with a girl who was Catholic. And for some reason, that's the way it went. It didn't seem to be Protestant girls finding Catholic boys. It was Protestant boys, or at least not Catholic boys. I'll just say it that. So what did they have to do if they wanted to get married? They had to become Catholic. They had to go through confirmation, catechisms, do things like they were a kid until the priest would say, okay, now you're a Catholic and now you can get married. And that's, I don't know if that's still how it's done, but when I was a kid, yes, sir.
Yeah, it's interesting. The young man came to our farm yesterday. I had to do some work for me. And it's the first time I've met him, so I was visiting with him. And he's living with a lady. He's 24 years old. They have two children, and a third is on the way. And so after some discussion, he said, I have a question for you. Why don't you get married?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's one that's the reverse way. Yeah.
She would have to go through the Catholic rigmarole.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not interested in doing that. And so there's
and of course, I'm sure you had the same thought I'm having of you would let that stand in the way of getting married, but it wouldn't let you stand in the way of living like you're married. I don't know how to say that well, but it's like,
it doesn't. It's not standing in the way of them living in sin.
Yes, exactly. That's what I mean. That's
far
a good.
More important than being staying away
yeah.
from
yeah. And
it's the same concept.
Yeah, it's the same concept. And so if there were non-Jewish children grow up in the area and one a child of a Jew wanted to marry a child of someone who followed one of these false religions, it's going to make it difficult to do that. I think, and I'm not questioning John MacArthur being correct there at all, but to me, when I read this, the main reason is he did not want any false religions to remain even known to the Jews. He didn't want his people stopping and thinking about Baal or one of the other false gods and going, well, now, why is my God the real one? These people worship Baal. Why isn't Baal real? I think God is looking for his society that he's going to build here, this nation, to be completely free from the influence of these false gods. And that they would recognize that they are so dangerous to who they were that you can't even say their name. And we know from what we will read in the rest of the Old Testament, they didn't do a very good job with this, did they? These false gods would get in. MacArthur mentions the intermarrying. Kings had a tendency to marry women who were children of other kings in other countries that followed other gods, and what a mess they had. Even to the point of, like in the case of Baal, without much doubt they were sacrificing their own children on the altar of Baal. What a price a people group, a nation, all of mankind pays when we do not worship God as God and shove aside everything that's false. What a price is paid. Okay. Well, any questions or comments? Next time we're going to start with verse 14. And we're going to talk about some feasts that God is going to establish. And so that's where we will begin. Thank you for your attention, and we'll start it in next time.